Michael Foster Rangers have these, they've developed these codes in terms of what the duty cycle of the elements should be being turned on, how many elements at one time for a given setting. And usually on a lot of these ranges, there's one range that actually has a thermostatic, you know, the thermocouple element, which is what they call precise temperature, where you can actually set the temperature that you want the pot to be at, rather than just high, medium, low. Okay, too hard.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I think you've gotten some of the answers you're looking for, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, you seem to think that this is thermostatic, because it seems to be fairly repeatable as far as the duty cycle, as they sort of go on and then go off. The periods seem to stay fairly constant for a particular percentage setting. But it was a curiosity question. Okay, now for my comment. I have a short recording of what I was asking about last week about these unusual tones I heard on some amateur frequencies.
And I'm going to inject before we go to that that my old-fashioned range, Best Buy or something like that, it's a brand that went out of business 25 years ago. And for me to buy replacement elements for it has been a dog of a problem.
What's the manufacturer name?
Say it again?
What's the actual manufacturer's name?
I'm going to have to get that for you. I keep forgetting it. But it's a company that went out of business 25 years ago, and it's a crazy size. My oven is an extremely narrow size. I can't find anything that size, even in the catalogs that are made for trailers, if you know what I mean. So I've got this problem of replacing either one is going to require a lot of modification of the kitchen. But my particular elements, I've been buying other brands of elements and trying to modify them to make them work with this range. And each one of my elements is a double element. And so I've got 8 different settings by way of a simple switch where if you feed 110 volts to the 2 windings in series, you get a small amount of heat. Feed one of the windings 110 volts complete and the other one, feed 110 into each, you get another one. Feed one of them 220 and one of them 110. Eventually, you're feeding 220 into each of the elements. You get full blast heat. So there's something like 8 settings there by way of various combinations of 110 and 220 into the 2 elements of a particular location where you put a pot. And whether they use in series, in parallel, or 110 or 220 is what's giving you all those various settings. That's how mine works. Over to you, Joe, W2RYY.
Dick, was that a tap-in? Tapping range?
Absolutely not. You know, during the time that Paul is giving us the space report, I'll take a walk to the kitchen and read that brand name again. I keep forgetting it. It's a brand that went out of business 25 years ago. For the next 5 years, if I would dig deep enough into the warehouses, they still had some spare parts. The spare parts ran out 20 years ago. So I'm now buying other brands and modifying them. So back to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay. I was still wondering how they come up with that duty cycle, how they come up with the arrangement of creating a certain duty cycle by a certain percentage of the heat. I'm not sure if it's thermostatic controls controlling this thing or whatever. And the elements I have are called towel rod. That's what makes them. And they just simply have 2 prongs on them. So there's nothing, there's no temperature sensing within the elements of my particular instrument. And it's, the stove. And it goes back to about, I think the stove is about the vintage 1960s, maybe early 70s. So it definitely doesn't have a microprocessor. Now, would you like to hear what I recorded last week about that question I asked you about the odd tones on some frequencies?
We've got 2 more people waiting in the wings, and I'm going to put a delay on it, this one tonight, Joe. One other thing I was going to mention is that the heating element of an electric range is a beautiful definition, a beautiful demonstration of conservation of energy. You and I can buy a room heater where the manufacturer will say it's a quartz heater that runs at 100% efficiency. Or you should buy this brand because it's got the latest exotic materials in there. Well, if the actual heating element was made out of nichrome, stainless steel, carbon,
even granules, whatever. Doesn't matter. Any heating element, you're putting electrical power into it and converting that into heat. As a heat converter, it's always 100% efficiency. It has no choice. Well, there's a slight exception to that. If you put a great big inductor in series with it, yes, you've got some reactive current going on. Therefore, that phase angle will give you something different. But as long as you know that it's a pure resistive element, I don't care if it's quartz, nichrome, or whatever, and you know the amount of current and voltage going into it, you know exactly how many joules per second of an energy it's receiving, you know exactly how many BTUs of heat it's generating, it has no choice. It either is taking that electrical power and turning it into heat, or by some magic of reactants, or, you know, a great big coil in series, it's sending it back to loco, if you know what I mean. In that one case, with a great big inductor in there, let me drop it. If you had a great big inductor in there, where you've now got reactive power, yes, the current that you measure with your clamp-on ammeter and the watts of real energy being delivered will be different. But that's a rare case. In your case, whatever current you're measuring with your clamp-on ammeter, and if you know that it's exactly 240 volts, so to speak, you know exactly how many joules of energy has gone into it, and then by a conversion, you know exactly how many BTUs of heat has to be coming out. Maybe that's some of the answer you're looking for, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll have to comment, hang in there till the end of, you got two more people asking questions, and then before you go to the mailbag, how's that?
Very kind, Joe. The next person on the list was Steve, KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
So we have a big comment?
Now let me pick up Steve first, because your signal is so noisy. Rich, we only hear you 50% of the time. So the people who are supplying you an antenna at your rehabilitation house are going to have to, in the future, give you a little more antenna as I see it. Steve, KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
KD2HUC. Good evening, Dick. My question tonight is just kind of for my own information. I was doing some reading during the week, a couple of good articles regarding tube amplifiers, or afterburners as you call them. And I read a, there was a gentleman who was looking to increase the capacity of his amplifier, and in the comments, you know what, let me let it drop. There were a few guys who wrote in saying by adding additional tubes, you don't increase the capacity of the amplifier or the amount put out. Now, for a power engineer like myself, that's kind of like a hard pill to swallow. You know, you put two equal transformers in parallel, you double the power. You know, cables, you double the power. So, is it true to increase the, you know, if you increase the number of tubes, of course, assuming that the power supply can handle it and so on and so forth, is it true that even increasing the number of tubes in an amplifier will not increase the, you know, the gain of the amplifier? That's my question. KD2HUC, back to net.
Use a little less audio. Yeah, I was going to tell Steve that I'm listening to him on both the input on 975, 375, as well as the output. Your audio is a little bit heavy, Steve. And when you do speak loudly, you overmodulate one of our transmitters, and therefore on 8.5, you're dropping out. I'm with you. Under normal circumstances, more tubes in an amplifier, assuming your re-impedance matching when you add the extra tubes, you should produce more power output. I can see a slight exception to that.
More power supply.
Yeah. Assuming the power supply has got the current capability, but as you put more tubes in parallel, you you need more drive power to turn both tubes on, if there's two tubes versus one. The gain, power input versus power output ratio, might not change with one tube properly impedance matched in and out, and two tubes properly impedance matched in and out. But the two tubes in parallel, probably impedance match in and out,
if you're willing to put twice as much drive in, you can try twice as much power output before it saturates. But the actual gain, decibels of gain, of one tube versus two tubes properly being matched, the gain might be the same. Does that make a little... Because with the two tubes, you need twice the number of watts in order for each tube the same to see the right amount of watts it's needed to produce full power. Is that making a little more sense there, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I see. So you would... So it's not... You actually have to increase what you're putting into the tubes, so you'd actually be dividing it amongst two tubes, so therefore the ratio doesn't change, but the actual output power could. So in order, say, if you were going from one to two tubes, if you were driving with 50 watts, you would have to drive with 100 watts, so the decibels doesn't really change, even though the output wattage does change. Am I getting that right?
Jake, if each tube has 6 dB of gain, what do you get when you put two of them in parallel?
6 dB of gain. Why would the answer be any different, Eric?
Well,
had we let Joe drop the transmitter and I picked him up, I was about to say, give that man a cigar. He's got it. And our broadcast engineer in this particular case might not have it. If one tube gives me 6 dB of gain, and when I'm putting 1 watt in, I get 4 watts out of that one tube. And now I've got two tubes in parallel. I can put 2 watts in, and I can get 8 watts of output, but I'm still getting 6 dB of gain. K2EJ, K2IW, defend yourself, Eric.
No, I only brought it up so you can visually see what happens when you put two amplifiers in parallel. Now you have to add them together, okay, if you want to look at it from as an input that goes through, let's say, a T or a network that feeds the grids of both tubes. We've got the output of both tubes, and they have to be combined. So each tube having 6 dB of gain, the entire circuit has 6 dB of gain.
You and I are saying the same thing. Eric was saying it from a different point of view. I was saying one tube versus two tubes where everything is impedance matched on the input and the output. You have more peak envelope power capability with the two tubes, but you better have more drive capability in order to be able to use it. So that's what I think is going on here, Steve. And so, out of curiosity, what brand of amplifier is this where you can decide how many tubes you're going to plug into it? Unusual. Because when you add that second tube, you've got to re-impedance match both the input circuit and the output circuit in order to make everything fly. A pair of tubes in parallel is going to act like one single tube, which has got twice as much plate area, twice as many watts of plate dissipation, but the two tubes in parallel now has an apparent plate impedance that's half the number of ohms of one tube. So you got to do some impedance matching in and out when you put a pair of tubes in parallel versus one tube. So what brand was that, Steve? KD2HUC, are you going to buy it? K2IW in the TechNet?
Dick, I don't think it was a commercially available amp. This was an article on eham.net, and I believe the gentleman was going to wanted to make a homebrew modification to his existing amplifier. And, you know, that's where all the comments had come in, saying that, you know, increasing the number of tubes is not going to increase the gain. And now I see the standpoint, you know, that they're referring to. The ratio is not going to change, but the peak envelope power coming out of the thing will change. So I think I got it now. It was more of a play on words.
Yes, the peak envelope power coming out is now going to get twice as high, but the peak envelope power of your drive to the two tubes also has to get twice as high. You're not getting something for nothing here. But when it comes to tubes in parallel, I have lived in that world since 1971. 1971 is the year that I first built something called the RIW Strip Line Parallel Kilowatt Amplifier for 432, a pair of 4CX250B tubes. And lots of people said, boy, those tubes got to be perfectly matched or it's going to blow up. And I said, you're crazy. In order to prove that, in order to actually do this, I had the two tubes running in parallel, producing a full 700 watts of output with a kilowatt of power input. In those days, you used to measure input power to match the FCC rules. Let me drop it. In order to prove to people that the tubes didn't have to be matched, I, of course, would take healthy brand-new tubes and old-fashioned tubes that were pulled from an FAA transmitter that had been used for a zillion years and put one of each in there, and it flew like a charm. But the most extreme case I would do is operate the transmitter in full power output, 700 watts, key down, turn off the filament on one of the tubes, let it cool off.
That's not nice.
Whip that beep plus off. You didn't let me say that. Beep plus was off. I turned off one filament, let it cool off, then turned the transmitter back on, and now I got exactly half power output. If and only if I readjusted the tuning and loading controls on the strip line output resonator circuit. When only one tube was alive, and the other tube is sitting there thoroughly inert with a cool filament. It is twice the plate impedance. You have to lighten up the loading control in order for that to work correctly. So the nice thing about parallel transmitters, when they're properly designed, even on a microwave frequency of 432, putting the tubes in parallel, make it act like one beautiful bigger tube, but still doesn't have the transit time loading effects, if you know what I mean. You get the size advantage of the small spacing between the cathode and the plate of each of the tubes, but the tube acts like it's got twice as big an anode, which it really does, because of what the strip line, the white piece of strip line is doing. See, that makes a little more sense to you, Steve. KD2HUC, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I got one more comment.
Yeah, Steve first and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, that brings up another topic that we're going to have to talk about, Dick, because I just got my hands on the ARRL book of standard amplifier designs, and they have a 432 strip-watt amplifier, and it doesn't have K2RIW on it. So I'm wondering if somebody got a little handy with a copy machine. I'm curious. I can't listen to TechNet on the Western repeater anymore. It's coming out the COMAC. It's all noise. It's I don't know if has anything changed, because I was always able to listen on the Western, and now I have to stay on the Eastern. Just curious. KD2HUC, back to net.
I lowered that earlier, Dick.
Yes, Steve, you keep forgetting to lower the audio, and you keep dropping out of one of the machines, not both. And I'm using, I'm listening to the output from the Western machine, and it's normal. So maybe something has changed with your antenna. But what I think you're about to tell me, Eric, is that if you ever run a transmitter with full B-plus and full drive, and you start skimping on filament voltage power, and start letting that filament cool off, when it's in that intermediate state of not full temperature, nasty things are happening to that cathode that are damaging. A cathode that's thoroughly cold, no problem. Cathode that's up to full temperature, almost no problem. But somewhere in between, I think you're doing damage to the cathode. That's what I believe a broadcast engineer would tell me. KE2EJ, who uses some very expensive tubes, and he's got to treat them with tender, loving care. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, I'm listening to both of these at the same time. Well, as far as I can see, the output of the repeater is still what it always is. And he really needs to lower his audio. The reason why he's dropping out of the other machines is going through another RF link, which the audio is not adjusted exactly perfect, so it tends to want to go out of the bandpass a little bit faster there when it's got something that's too loud to start with. Don't forget these repeaters have DSPs in them. They're supposed to prevent that kind of stuff from happening, but there's a limit as to how much they want to go and compress them. I was going to tell you, cutting off the filament while you've got high voltage, not very nice. You know, triodes, you can almost get away with it, but with a tetrode, you really ask for an awful lot of trouble. Once the temperature of the filament gets down to that midpoint that we're talking about, the cathode starts to boil. You don't want that to happen. You know, that would take a, you know, 3 or 4 years off the life of a tube if you're good at keeping your tubes on really fast. that is a bad thing. But what I was going to suggest, let me let it drop for a second. Well, I was going to suggest to the gentleman that wanted to add a tube, well, I think he was saying that it's making 300 watts out. Well, I could show you a tube that you can put 300 watts into it. All you have to do is build another little cabinet, and you can get 2 kilowatts PP for your sideband operation without too much fuss and bother. And you don't have to disturb the existing amplifier. Get your IWK, do check.
Yeah, if you've got a well-designed amplifier that has a good track record, good reliability, good efficiency, good power output, and so on, and you want to have twice the power output, and now you take this Cadillac of an amplifier from my description and buy another of them, and now you use the world's best technique, in my opinion, the so-called Kurokawa technique. Mr. Kurokawa got a lot of awards for inventing this technique. It really is a power divider. It's called a 3dB quadrature hybrid. It's a very fancy kind of directional coupler. It's not expensive. But you put a quadrature hybrid on the input of the two amplifiers, one input connector, two output connectors on the quadrature hybrid going to the two amplifiers. So you're feeding the two amplifiers 90 degrees out of phase. And you use another quadrature hybrid on the output, and you're recombining the two of them. At first you say, hey, it's crazy. Why do I delay the phase of one amplifier versus the other on the input, and delay the phase of one amplifier versus the other on the output? Why do all this delaying? Well, the magic that Mr. Kurokawa discovered, let me drop it, is that in the case of using modern-day transistors, where the input impedance of the damn transistor might be 1 ohm, and the output impedance might be 3.5 ohms, resistive, and a huge amount of reactance of some kind, a very difficult impedance to live with, and to do, you do the best thing you can with fancy strip-lined impedance-matching circuits in order to match the input and output impedance on each individual transistor, but of course, it's a band of interest, you're never going to get a perfect match. The magic of a quadrature hybrid used correctly, where the fourth port has got a dummy load. The input impedance you see will always be perfect 50 ohms. The output impedance of an amplifier will always be 50 ohms, even though the individual amplifiers, the input impedance is pretty yucky and the output impedance is pretty yucky. As long as the two amplifiers are impedance-wise matched, they can be pretty bad, but as long as they're identical to each other, the magic of that quadrature hybrid makes the two acting together act perfect on an input impedance and perfect on output impedance. On top of that, the quadrature hybrids give you perfect isolation between the two amplifiers. If one amplifier wants to oscillate because it starts seeing the other amplifier, because those quadrature hybrids, it does not see the other amplifier. It's a really beautiful circuit. Highly stable, highly impedance matched, twice the power output, except for the fact you've got to supply these pair of quadrature hybrids. And I'm trying to think of the Zinger is the name of one of the world's best. Oh, I can't think of the brand name of Zinger. Eric's going to tell that to me. But the beautiful quadrature hybrids, a nice simple little circuit as far as physical package is concerned.
You're talking through one right now.
Yeah, what's the brand name of that Zinger? That Zinger company. By the way, I talked to the guy with a doctorate degree working for that company who designed the Zinger. Man, that guy really knows what he's doing. What's the name of that company in Upper New York State, Eric? Go ahead.
Are you talking about Dielectric?
No. Zinger is the popular model number. There's a whole series of Zingers. One of the Zingers, for instance, gives you an impedance match from close to 500 to 1,000 megahertz, and it's the impedance match is never more than 2/10 of a dB wrong, and the phase shift is never more than a couple of degrees across 500 to 1,000 megs, and the thing can take 100 watts, and it's in a package about 1 inch square and about 1/8 inch thick. Fantastic piece of electronics. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
I'm not quite sure what it is that you're saying. Zinger?
Yes. The company, which I can't think of the name of the damn company's brand name right now, has a series of quadrature hybrids intended for solid-state circuitry, very low profile, very high efficiency.
P-circuit?
Again?
P-circuit.
Absolutely not Mini Circuits. It's a company in Upper New York State, darn good company, that makes a series of printed circuits, quadrature hybrids, power dividers, and whatever. And one series of their quadrature hybrids are called the Zinger series, Zinger number 5 or Zinger number 3 or whatever. And they're extremely broadband, extremely well matched in amplitude and phase. They're not very expensive, and other than that, they're good. Well, before we sign off tonight, I'll eventually find that brand name.
Do they look like little silver squares with the leads coming out of the ends of it?
You got it. Tabs coming out of the four corners, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, now I'm trying to remember the name. I think it starts with an A. I'm not positive. I could actually go open up one of the amplifiers and look. But the computers actually use that circuit and use those 90-degree hybrids as the inputs and outputs. And that, in turn, winds up going to another Wilkinson divider, and then it goes out.
The name of that company is Aderant. You gave it to me. Aderant. Aderant is an Upper New York State company.
That's a
real good group of guys, and they make an excellent product. The Aderant Zinger series of quadrature hybrids, 90-degree hybrids. Fantastic. And Mr. Kurikawa won a whole lot of IEEE awards for inventing that amplifier technique. And now, if you want a zillion watts out of your solid-state transistors, and now you use enough quadrature hybrids cascaded, so you've got a whole Christmas tree on the input, where you divide up the power to 10 different amplifiers, and then another Christmas tree of quadrature hybrids on the output, where you take the 10 amplifiers and put it all back together again. Now, each of those 10 amplifiers do not see each other. They're super stable, super efficient, super good in input impedance, super good in output impedance. Other than that, it's good. Mr. Kurikawa really knew what he was doing. Okay, that's the subject of amplifiers. I know that John's got a question tonight. KC2WGB, you're normally supplying information. Why are you asking questions, John? Over to you, John. K2RIW.
KC2WGB, I know I'm a dummy and I'm trying to get all the secrets out of you. Let me do a drop. Okay, Dick, quick question. Got a receiver and a length of wire going to an antenna, and I'm tuning between 1 and 2 gig. In that antenna lead, there's a T. Alright, now, I have another antenna that's developed with an extremely high Q at 1.5 gig. I take that antenna, put it in a Faraday cage, or a waveguide beyond cutoff element that keeps that thing hearing and seeing nothing. When I plug that into that T, that particular antenna, would that definitely cause a measurable attenuation at that frequency on the receiver? I hope I made that clear enough. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yes, but it depends. Now, you've got an antenna inside of an anechoic chamber, or it's a waveguide beyond cutoff, where the antenna in the world it's living in, it cannot do any radiating. We're assuming it's a high efficiency antenna. It doesn't have carbon granules or an attenuator anywhere. So if I put an antenna inside of the screen room, for instance, depending on the dimensions of the screen room, the actual impedance I see on the input of the antenna is always going to be an infinite Dizwar of the dimensions of the screen room, and where the antenna is located in that screen room could change the phase angle of the 100% reflection coefficient. Now, that phase angle coming back to your T through a length of cable, and that length of cable to the center of the T is another impedance inverter by way of a Smith chart or whatever. In the worst case, if the length of cable from the antenna in the screen room back to the center of the T, if that length of cable happened to be an odd number of quarter wavelengths, a short circuit at one end would be an open circuit on the other end. That's why they call it an impedance inverter. So the actual impedance, let me drop. The actual impedance you're going to get at the center of that T can be anything in the world. If my antenna in the screen room just happens to be a perfect short circuit, and if the length of line going back to the T is a quarter wavelength or an odd number. The shorter one end is open on the other end. Therefore, that arm of the T is an open circuit. It's as if you had cut it off with an axe or it's not even there. No effect on the receiver at all at that frequency.
You're not transmitting out of cell then.
Sheldon is back on now. So, I dropped it long enough to reset Sheldon. So, Sheldon's back on. Let me drop. Yeah, Sheldon's back on. And the audio out of Sheldon is a little bit less than desirable, but Eric's working on that. So, as you can tell, what you're trying to do is to create a notch in the performance of the T-connector going to the receiver from the antenna. And you have the raw ingredients to make it happen. If the length of line from the T to the antenna in the screen room was a trombone, and you adjust the length of the trombone, you will find a notch in that receiver, John. It's starting to make a little more sense. And by the way, very few people other than guys with quite a few years of antenna experience would know the answer to this one. You're in a fairly tough area as far as the book learning and the school classes that we can take, Eric. Ahead, John. KC2WGB, you're going to have to hear this a couple more times to make it make sense. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I understand. The link to the coax is important. Also, my next feature is going to be I'm going to put a little trimmer capacitor on that device in the waveguide beyond cutoff so that I can adjust it for specifics and try to get it a little tighter. Okay, I just wanted to make sure before. I didn't want to be wasting my time. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
And what you're doing, John, is a viable approach. But true of all microwave circuits where everything is distributed, you add a capacitor. And you think schematically, hey, you've got a capacitor. Well, the leads on the capacitor are also a series inductor. The piece of coax cable going from the T connector over to the antenna in the anechoic chamber, I'm going to call it. That's another network of LCs, even though it doesn't look as... I mean, the equivalent circuit of a transmission line is a whole cascading of series inductors and parallel capacitors, a whole series of them. That's one way of making an equivalent circuit of a transmission line. To your eye, when you take that transmission line apart, a piece of coax cable, it looks simple. Electronically, at a microwave frequency, it's anything but simple. Yeah, at 80 meters, it's simple. At 500 megacycles, all hell breaks loose. Everything up there is a distributed world. No matter what you've got, no matter how short your leads are, there's a stray inductance. No matter how big your capacitor is, there's always some extra stray capacitance and so on. And there's coupling coefficients between all of the nearby components. They're radiating to each other. The microwave world has got a whole brand new set of rules that you've got to follow. And the way the schools teach microwave antenna engineering is such that almost nobody can walk out of that class and do microwave antenna engineering. They've got a bunch of raw ingredients that are not put together in a way where they can go out of there whistling that tune. You talk to the real guys that are doing microwave antenna engineering for the last 20 years, they've got a whole series of rules of thumb that they use that works for them, which is very different from all the book learning, if you know what I mean. So they got their own set of tricks that work, and a hell of a lot of things you think are impossible.
Repeater, time out.
Okay, the Eastern input is on. It went off for a few seconds, but it came back on again. So you've got a simple looking circuit. You've got a simple looking circuit that's got a whole lot of variables. You've got a bunch of knobs in your hand that you don't even know that are there, if you know what I mean. Length of cable, coax impedances, length of the antenna inside the chamber, where it's located inside the chamber, whether or not the chamber is acting as an inductive short circuit or a capacitive short circuit. It's really a horn that's beyond cutoff, but how many wavelengths of horn is there between the antenna and the open throat? I mean, the word waveguide beyond cutoff is a relative set of words. There still is a signal propagating. It happens to have 100 dB of loss per foot. There's still a kind of propagation going on in a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff. Okay, out of curiosity, John, what are you seeing on the Echo Link and Chat Room and whatever. Is this a light night or a heavy night? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
KC2WGB. Average night, Dick. We've got about 8 on Echo Link. It varies between 8 and 9. It's been going back and forth. And had a question from the chat room, which I will broach in a little while. But, you know, you're absolutely right. When I look at that antenna in the Faraday cage on the vector network analyzer, whatever I do, even if I move a piece of the coax cable, which is not shielded, it's after the separation of the shield, if I bend that in a different way, you get different results. It's really very critical. But, yeah, a lot of fun.
You're doing a very educational process there, John. And by the hard school of knocks of doing it empirically, you're finding out what works and what doesn't work for you. You're in the process of what every good microwave antenna engineer has to do. You're in the process of forming your own rules of thumb. You're finding out what, with your kind of instrumentation, your understanding, the way your hands work, the way your soldering iron works, you're finding out what works for you. And there's a lot of ways of doing it. And as you guys have heard me say quite often, I found my own ways of doing it. And the skilled antenna engineers think I'm crazy, think it can't possibly work. And yet a fair number of patents have flowed out of those things that can't work. And they're working, and they're being manufactured. At the time we go to the mailbag, John, we've gone an hour and 50 minutes. We've gone 50 minutes beyond the time that we should have started the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. It'll be quick. It won't be, we're never too late, really. Okay, I have a gentleman by the name of Max who's asking a question about a 2-meter dipole antenna. His question is, if he constructs a 2-meter dipole and starts out with the elements, large element diameters, and tapers it like a pencil to the end, what effect would that have on the antenna? Would it be measurable? And would it really make a difference? Why he wants to do this, I don't know, but it's his question. So I'm sure you can handle that one, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, a number of the antennas that I've worked on, John, did just that. There's a whole advantage and disadvantage of tapering where it's fat in the center and skinny at the ends, fat everywhere, or fat on the ends and skinny in the center, and all other kinds of variations and the rate of taper. There's a whole bunch of advantages. If you're starting off with a frequency like 915 megacycles, for instance, which is a very good frequency when it comes to RFID devices. Let me drop. And now you can make antennas that are, a dipole is going to be 4 1/2 inches long, and you're making it out of copper tape, or aluminum tape. It's got to be copper tape, because you have to solder to it periodically. And now you take it with a tuning tool, a long wooden stick, a skewer stick, with a chunk of copper tape on the end of it, and you're adding the chunk of copper tape in various places, near the center of the dipole, near the tip of the dipole, halfway in between, and you're watching it on a vector network analyzer that is simultaneously measuring standing wave ratio and gain. Standing wave ratio, in my case, is being displayed as a yellow curve on this XY plot, and the gain is being displayed as a blue curve on this yellow plot, and you do all kinds of fiddling in order to make the blue curve go up while the yellow curve goes down. And when you do that just right, you're maximizing the gain and minimizing the VISWR simultaneously. You're looking at both at the same time in real time. That good vector network analyzer made by Rode & Schwartz, for instance, is giving you 30 displays per second across that whole frequency region. You don't see any flicker. From your point of view, everything you see is real time. The curve moves as fast as you can move your fingers or your hand, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. By that process, you can do the equivalent of 100 antenna designs in an 8-hour day. Each time you move another piece of copper tape near the center, near the middle, near the end, off to the left, off to the right, bend the dipole, clockwise, counterclockwise. But each one of those pieces of a copper tape held near the antenna, near the end, near the tip, near the center, put down onto the board, soldered down. Each one of those is a brand new antenna design with a real display a fraction of a second away from when you did it. You try to do that by computer modeling. All of those antenna designs that I can test in one day. You try to do that by computer modeling. You will not live long enough, and you will not get an answer that's accurate. Other than that, it's not very good. So, computer modeling, without a doubt, in certain environments, is a stroke of genius. Does beautiful things in certain environments. But if you're trying to build a microwave, broadband, low vis wire, high performance antenna, computer modeling is out the window. Forget it. They're not even close. When I come up with a damn good design, and now I try to plug all those parameters into a computer model to find out how good is it, the computer model says, that ain't working. And yet, there it is. And if you think that it's just instrumentation error, you now connect it to a real transmitter and receiver, and you get excellent performance. And you try it on two or three different vector network analyzers, and you get damn good performance on the vector network analyzer of various brands and various model numbers. It's real. Even though the computer model says, no, that's not working. The computer model just can't tolerate very wide conductors and give you accurate answers. The computer models that are available today cannot handle that yet. Let me drop. Each time I say those words to a person who is familiar with computer modeling, he thinks I'm dead wrong. He has been led to believe that the computer modeling can do everything. As you've heard me say so often, the majority of companies that I have ever heard of that are building antennas, the defenders of antennas, domestically and foreign, many of them are bragging about the fact we model it first and then we build it. And they think they have found the magic recipe of success. For a certain class of antennas, yes. For the really high-performance antennas I'm looking for, no way in hell. And they still don't believe me. So, there's a great big gap. I'm slowly assembling a presentation that I'm going to be giving to the IEEE Consultants Network and eventually the other senior engineers society on Long Island. It's going to take me a while, but I'm slowly coming up with a presentation that's going to have computer-generated graphics and photographs and whatever of past performance along these lines and the pictures of the individual claims of the individual patents where this thing is taking place. You take a look at the three element Yagi. I guess I should give you guys the serial number. If you simply Google my name with my address and you do a search on the PTO, the patent and transit, what is it now called? Patent and, can't even think of it. Patent and trademark. That's the word, patent and trademark office. You Google my word and you find this Yagi-like antenna. You look at that thing, you look at the photograph of that thing. Well, it's a line drawing. And you'll say, gee, I've never seen a Yagi that looks like that. It's got the crazy bumps in funny places. Why the hell would you do that? And the answer, it gives you high performance. And to model it is very, very difficult.
I've got a comment there.
Go right ahead, Eric.
I want to kind of add this to your thinking. And it's a good comeback for people who talk about modeling programs. Modeling programs are only as good as the individual or group of individuals that write it and take what they consider to be the variables involved in the environment in which they're trying to create this. That's all the thing is going to be capable of doing. All these other things that you find are important, they have no awareness, no consciousness of. Therefore, it can't be put into a modeling program. The reality is, if someone like you were to write a program and put all those variables and bring all the things that your knowledge has into that piece of software, then you will find something that works to your satisfaction, but only under those given circumstances involving those particular frequencies, that particular amount of gain, and so on and so forth. K2RIWK2J.
You're here.
Yep, I agree with most of what you said, Eric. Part of what's going on is that the person writing the computer program, he probably only is a software writing maven, but his knowledge of deep RF microwave experience probably is light.
Oh, that's right on.
That's part of the disconnect. But even if you had a good RF maven who's got a good computer science background, and now he's writing the software, it would be better, but there's still a problem. A very wide conductor, as far as wavelengths are concerned, I'm talking about things that are close to a quarter wavelength wide of a resonator that you and I call driven element, or the director and reflector. When you start approaching quarter wavelength in width, and now you try to model that, you're making finite elements. That's a fancy way of saying you're dividing it up into 1,000 individual little bitty triangles. And inside of each one of those triangles, by a reiterative technique of the computer modeling program, you have to find essentially the exact current magnitude and exact current phase of each one of those triangles of that finite element, and there's 1,000 of them. And now you take that great big 1,000 by 1,000 complex matrix, and you have to be able to invert it and still keep the accuracy, which would require more than double precision accuracy to make that work. The mathematics of that is so fierce that modern day programs and modern day programmers cannot handle it. However, Mother Nature has got the magic. The way those electrons flow in that wide piece of copper, Mother Nature knows exactly how to do it. And on that vector network analyzer, she's doing it every single microsecond. Let me drop. Mother Nature is doing the real thing. And your vector network analyzer has the smarts and the speed to display it to you, the exact standing wave ratio and the exact gain. And there it is on the screen as a beautiful display in milliseconds. That's the real answer. Doesn't require post-computer optimization to get rid of the errors. There are essentially no errors. It's real world. So it's a different philosophy of it.
Let me stop you.
And go right ahead. It's a different philosophy of design. You've got it, Eric.
Now let's go back to the 40s, where you had a guy called Brown and Woodward, and they decided that they were going to try and figure this out. Well, what's to stop someone from doing exactly that with this particular application? Okay, if you can stand there with and have a vector network analyzer in front of you, and you can make all the different possible changes, and you find the sweet spots, you find the things that work, what is there now to take that, what's to stop you from taking that data and incorporating it into the next version of your modeling program so to accommodate what nature does, okay? And as far as, like, you're saying, you know, if we're talking about doing a billion calculations, that's not unrealistic today. The damn DSP in your TV set that lets you see a freaking picture is doing a half a billion calculations per second. All right, so, you know, the ability of having the computer power is becoming much less of a problem. Think about anything that we do in calculus, which is basically recursive. It's, you know, it's a Mac and an ad. It's not complex. You can do integration, differentiation, summation, all by using simple mathematical operations. And the speed at which we can do them today is getting faster and faster and faster. So, I don't particularly agree with that part of the argument.
With the raw data I've given you, let me wait, this machine gives me full audio here. Yeah. With the raw data I'm giving you, Eric, you've chosen an extremely obvious, what's the word for it now, good common sense answer with the raw data I've given you, and you've come to a conclusion. Now let me show you what's going on. I'm going to have to ask you a two-step process to get to the bottom of what's going on here. Let's assume now that I got a very wide conductor for the driven element, director, reflector of a three-element Yagi, and I've carefully chosen the spacing between them and the twists and turns between them and the equivalent of the boom between them and the width of the boom. I've chosen all of those things. I've now broken it up by finite elements to really represent that I've got to make close to 1,000 finite elements. And in order to go the next step of that modeling, the reiterative function of the program has to find exact amount of current and the exact phase angle of the current in each one of those 1,000 triangles by an iterative process. Step number one in my question, how does the machine do that? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Okay. Are we saying that for each triangle there's an algorithm that sticks and we can apply it to all the triangles we're talking about?
It really is a 1,000 by 1,000 wide by 1,000 high matrix, because each and every one of those triangles has a finite, predictable amount of coupling coefficient to all 999 of the other triangles. They're all interacting fantastically, continuously, during the time that you're trying to, by a reiterative process, finally make this thing settle down as to what is the estimated current and estimated phase angle inside of each one of those triangles that are all coupled to each other. That's the first step of what I'm about to ask you, Eric. Over to you. How does the machine do that? K2RAW.
Okay. So, let me ask you. We have now set up a matrix of 1,000 by 1,000 triangles. We know what the coupling between each one is and the inductance, the capacitance. And are we talking about this at a molecular level?
At 915 megacycles, if you did that with a whole bunch of squares of roughly 1 millimeter, you'd come pretty close. So 1 millimeter squares, 1 millimeter triangle, and you want to know the current magnitude and the current phase angle of each one of them before you go to the next step. Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Okay. The next question is, are we exciting this via we're feeding something into it, or are we exciting this via picking up something, so to speak?
That doesn't matter. By the laws of reciprocity, whether it's a receiver or a transmitter, in theory the answer is the same. Back to you, Eric.
Okay, so we can create a reference to say that we're going to feed this much energy into this particular group of triangles. So, are you saying that you cannot calculate the current voltage at each one of these triangles based on an input? And at 900 megahertz, one cycle, are we waiting 1 cycle, 10 cycles, 100 cycles? Because you didn't mention the word average and talking about settling time here, yes?
Without a doubt, this thing has a very finite settling time. As you first turn on that transmitter, the nearby triangles have a lot of energy that hasn't yet coupled to the far away triangles. But the interconnections, the number of paths between each triangle and all the others, is such a large number that you could write 1,000 simultaneous equations if you wanted to, and then solve the 1,000 variables that are inside of each of those 1,000 simultaneous equations. In theory, you could do that. Are you starting to see a little bit about what's involved here? And by the way, this is just the first step. When you think you've got a good answer for this, I'm about to hit you with the second step. Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Okay, since this is a technical, educational, intelligent endeavor, okay, we don't necessarily have to put a time frame on it. I can do, I can get a machine that does 60 teraflops and put it on my desk. But the reality is, we were going to, say, develop a device just for this purpose, we could take some of the ECL bit slices and swap that together, and we can do a trillion calculations in, 10 hours. If we know what the calculation is, we know, we're going to do a little Ohm's law here, we're going to do a little interpolation, we're going to see what the interaction between the two of them are. What's this? That is a raccoon. Go away, raccoon. If you can do it, if you can isolate one element of it and create the algorithms for it, you can have a billion of them. Doesn't mean we can't calculate them.
I didn't say you can't calculate it, but it turns out that the number of unknowns is considerably greater than the number of knowns. I've got a very wide piece of sheet metal that has an
arbitrary perimeter, which is not straight and flat. It's curved and it's got bumps and whatever. It's got an extremely complicated perimeter.
All right, I get what you're saying. Well, cutting away from what I started out by saying is that, just like Brown and Woodward, you can take that particular type of antenna and the particular quirks of that particular antenna and turn that into an algorithm and use it.
Good guess, but I think the answer is no, Eric. Now, with that exotic perimeter of this wide piece of sheet metal, and you've got close to 1,000 little triangles of analysis across that sheet of sheet metal, you only know a rough approximation of the coupling coefficient of triangle number 541 into triangle number 2. You only know the rough approximation of the magnetic and resistive apparent coupling coefficient. And by a reiterative process, you plug in all of your estimations of those complex coupling coefficients and then try to excite it and find out if it settles down and if you have a solution. And of course, for the first 1,000 tries, you do not. And now you've got to modify all of those numbers to try to come to a solution. But here's the next step. This is step number 2. When you finally come, when it finally settles down after hours of grinding of these approximations, and you finally found out what the real coupling coefficient has got to be so that the thing will settle down for measurable currents in various places that approximately matches what you can measure on the real element. Now you with your tuning tool, let me drop this. You with your tuning tool, with your chunk of copper on the end of it, put it near or actually touch the perimeter of this thing. You're watching it on the vector network analyzer. The VisWire has either gone up or gone down at that frequency region. Maybe on the low frequency it got better or the high frequency it got bad, and the gain got better all over the place, and you're looking for a better location. But you put down your piece of copper in your tuning procedure, and on the vector network analyzer you've got an answer in milliseconds. But every one of those currents and every one of those squares in magnitude and phase has just changed when you did that. Do you see what you're up against in the modeling program in the real dirt world of empirical tweaking that I do on a VNA? You can see why I get an answer in milliseconds.
Yes, but you're not following what I'm saying. You're very much in what your experience is. I'm trying to take you in a different direction. Let me let it drop.
You're leading me down the garden path, Eric. Go ahead.
Let's say we put a group of people together. You happen to be there, okay? And the purpose of this group is to try and create a computer program that actually follows nature, so to speak, okay? Was that you do your thing. Every measurement that you took, when you went here, it went down in gain. And when you went here, it went up in gain. When you went over here, it affected the low end. When you went over there, it affected the high end. So take every little bit of that data that us human beings can take. And now let's try to structure a program that takes all that into consideration. One of the nice things about computers is that because in a case where you have more variables, more unknowns than you have knowns, you have a lot of tools. And as long as we have time, we can try many different kinds of things until we find one that actually agrees with what goes on in nature. Okay? And it's basically the more data that we can provide, and it will try and extrapolate from the information that we give it to come up with the same result that you got. What we're talking about here is not using something that already exists. We're trying to create something that follows your experience of working with things in nature.
If you are taking a artificial intelligence computer, no, I'm not looking. If you are programming a robot-like thing to move in a more precise manner with a long wooden stick and a piece of copper tape on the end of it, and you're programming this computer man-like thing to move around this device on a piece of plastic.
I don't care what the input of the device is, whether it's a human being or something automated.
But if you're making a computer substitute for what I did,
while looking at the VNA, yes, you can do it faster. If you try to do it by real, finite element computer modeling with a mini